and welcome to Film Footsteps. Each and every episode of this podcast, we pick a movie that inspired us to start our creative careers. The scenes, the scores, and the things that were personal to us. These are the footsteps in film that got us to where we are today. I'm Jason Inman.
I'm Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And neither of us are astronauts. We're just podcasters, but we're still going to try to talk about Apollo 13, today's movie. It's my choice, and it's a 1995 American space docudrama directed by Ron Howard, starring Tom Hanks, Mr. Kevin Bacon, Mr. Bill Paxton, Senora Ed Harris, and Mr. Gary Sinise. The screenplay was by William Broyles and Al Reinhart, and of course dramatizes the aborted 1970 Apollo 13 lunar mission. It's also based on a book called Lost Moon, The Perilous Voyage of Apollo 13 by astronaut Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. And just like their long journey, their long 8-day journey of perilous, non-breathing and everything like that, that was a long intro, wasn't it, Ashley?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were here to talk about Apollo 13. Are you excited about this? You like space, don't you?
I don't like space at all.
Well,
this is a movie and a string of media that Jason has encouraged me to watch where space is dangerous and it's scary.
Space is very dangerous and it's scary. And it's so dangerous and scary that when this was released in theaters in June 30th, 1995, it received wide critical acclaim and was nominated for 9 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Actor. It only won for Best Film Editing and Best Sound. And the film also won the Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Performance by a Cast, as well as 2 British Academy Film Awards.
BAFTAs.
Yeah, there's a lot of this stuff. So, do we want to talk about what it opened against before we get to talk why I picked this film?
What year is this again?
This is June 30th, 1995.
Sure.
Now, Ashley, you are not ready for this.
I would not have been cognizant of any of these films, so...
You are not ready.
Hit me, baby, one more time.
You are not ready for this. Would you like... Okay, I'm going to say, last time we talked about Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm-hmm. Our favorite.
It opened in 99.
Our favorite movie we've seen so far.
Against some big movies.
Yeah.
Now we're in June. We're in the summer. We're in summer. Yeah. Blockbuster season, 1995. Ashley.
Yeah.
Apollo 13 opened against a murderer's row of movies and still was number one.
Is one of them a Disney movie?
Yes. Now, I am probably going to tell you 15 other movies that this movie was against, and they are all big movies. But I would love for you to make a guess. I would love to see if you can hit any of these 15 movies.
The Lion King.
Incorrect.
Aladdin.
Incorrect.
I've got literally nothing.
So
I don't know what was on in 1995. I'm sorry.
I'm going to go through the list. I'm going to give you the top 15 movies for June 30th, 1995. And I'll bet you have heard of most of these.
You're going to give me the top 15?
The top 15.
I'm going to count how many I've seen.
Okay. You ready?
Yeah.
So number one, of course, was Apollo 13. It opened.
Sure.
Made $46 million its opening weekend.
More than Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yep. Number two. Pocahontas by Walt Disney.
Oh, Pocahontas.
Number three.
It's Judy Kuhn.
Batman Forever.
Mm. Have I seen Batman Forever?
No, you have not.
Okay, thank you.
Number four. Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the movie.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Number five. Judge Dredd, starring Sylvester Stallone.
Sure.
Number six. Congo, the Michael Crichton movie that stars Bruce Campbell and Tim Curry. Number seven, The Bridges of Madison County, starring Clint Eastwood. Number eight, Casper the Movie.
Oh, that's a good movie.
Number nine, Braveheart.
Oh, Braveheart.
Mel Gibson. Number 10, Die Hard with a Vengeance, Die Hard 3.
Mm.
Number 11, Crimson Tide, starring Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman.
Mm-hmm.
Number 12, and this is the one that I don't know. While You Were Sleeping. I don't know that
one. I don't know that one either.
Number 13, Bad Boys, the Will Smith, Martin. Number 14, I don't know this one, Forget Paris. Number 15 is Smoke, but I'm going all the way to number 16 because number 16 is a favorite movie of yours, Ashley. Kevin Costner's The Postman.
Oh, I mean, I'm not counting The Postman as something I've seen because we turned it off halfway through. So... from when we did Costner Christmas.
Who knew?
I've only seen four of those movies.
The summer of 1995 was so packed.
Yeah, but I mean, my question is, when did these movies open? Did they open that weekend?
I don't know. They were just they were all playing in theaters. I understand,
but it's I think that's, you know,
because I guarantee you, I think Braveheart opened in the spring.
I think so too. But this that was a time when movies ran in theaters for a
long time,
6 months. Yep. Braveheart might crop up here on this Heery podcast. At some point, for sure.
That would be a fun rewatch.
I think so.
I'll tell you what. If you do Braveheart.
You have to do Gladiator. We have to pair them together.
Yes, because we
for no one else other than for ourselves.
Yeah, because Gladiator is like that my historical classic movie that really actually was the first movie that made me realize that working in film could be a job.
Yeah.
So well, there we go. So I lost my place. Where did I first see this? I saw Apollo 13 on a VHS copy from the Walnut, Kansas Public Library. And two things stuck out to me. It stuck out to me because of space. Mm-hmm. And then also, I have always been able to hum this score by James Horner.
You do. You are a James Horner stan.
Because when he's good, he's good.
Yeah. 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 When you like James Horner, you really like
He's really good. I mean, I'll say this.
I mean, you can say that of every composer. But like, you can, like, I love Howard Shore. Yeah. And when Howard Shore was good, he's really good.
I can hum the Avatar, pieces from the Avatar score because of James Horner. And I still think to this day, it's the best thing from that movie.
There's literally no other redeeming qualities of that movie.
You are correct. okay, so do we want to get into what made me pick this film?
Sure.
So I watched this in high school. And this is like one of the first times that I really realized the importance of sort of a biofilm. Now, this is not a biofilm by True, because usually biofilms are like center around one person.
This is closer to a memoir where it's about a specific period of time.
Well, Wikipedia called this a docudrama, which I thought was very interesting.
I guess.
Because I said to you earlier that I feel that many parts of this movie feel like you're watching a documentary.
You said that when we were watching it.
Yes. But this is also, this is a movie that really showed to me that real life could be just as interesting as fiction.
Mm.
And this also is a movie that really showed to me what I like to call the style of invisible directing. When the directing and the editing are so good that you just disappear into the movie. You are completely just in the movie and you don't even realize the cuts, the shots, the act. You just go with it.
Mm.
And I think this entire movie is full of what I like to call invisible directing. It's like good lettering in a comic book. When it's so good that you don't even notice it.
Yeah. Yep, 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 yep.
And I think Ron Howard does this as well.
I think that's an interesting observation because to me, watching a Ron Howard movie is like watching a Disney movie. There is like...
I would love to hear... I don't understand that statement. I'd love to hear this.
The way... If you look at... You know
this
what
comparison.
You know what a natural piece of wood looks like?
Yes.
And then you know when you lacquer it? So that all the imperfections are gone and it's got a sheen on it and it's shiny and it's beautiful.
Lacquer actually brings the imperfections out. But
That to me is what a Ron Howard movie is.
Okay.
Like there is just, this movie does have like grit and realness and danger, but there is just something. It's like Ron Howard just like took a cloth and like wiped the screen for me. There's just something.
Yeah, I would say
goody two shoes about a Ron Howard film that I can't quite put my finger on.
You know, it's funny because when you talk about directors.
Yeah.
And Ron Howard, to me, is one of those directors that when he is at the top of his game.
He's very good.
When he is at the top of his game, he's invisible.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't really have a stylistic shot. And most of his movies are heartfelt. But when he is good, you don't feel him.
It's tone with Ron Howard. Ron Howard is a little saccharine.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, I feel like
Bridge of Spies, for example.
That was Spielberg.
I thought that was, never mind. That's just
Spielberg.
Kidding.
I was like, you feel Spielberg the second a Spielberg movie starts.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just something about this that's kind of gosh golly to me.
Well, to me, I was going to say like Ron Howard to me is what you would call a workman director. He disappears into the movie.
Uh-huh.
He puts the pieces together and the movie just runs. And when it runs solid, you're just like, this is a good movie.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Like, I mean, when he's at the highest power, he's directed like some of the best movies ever made.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
And Bryce has that too, I think.
So we added this segment last time. Could you please pull up the IMDb?
Oh, I've got it up.
And we will go through this cast by the IMDb star meter.
This one is a lot more accurate than Midsommar.
Should
was.
We explain? We didn't explain this last time. Would you like to briefly explain to our listeners?
Oh my God.
What is the ranking of the IMDb, the Internet Movie Database star meter? Like, how does this website determine
how many clicks your profile has?
Bingo.
How populous your profile is. So this is a completely arbitrary, absolute BS way to rank
it's
people.
It's a mob rule popular vote. Okay, so
yeah, they also have an article that says these stars are on the rise and everyone's headshot is over 40.
All right, so to me, this is a Tom Hanks movie.
Yep.
But it is going to be ridiculous if Tom Hanks is not number one. But I'm going to make the guess that number one is actually Kevin Bacon.
False.
Who is number one?
Tom Hanks.
Good. Good. Then all is right with the world.
Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton?
Kevin Bacon.
All right.
Gary Sinise, who has a great headshot, by
all
the
right,
way.
All right, so we're pretty standard.
Ed Harris.
Yep.
Kathleen Quinlan.
Kathleen Quinlan?
Yeah, she plays his wife.
I know who she is, but I'm surprised she's that high.
Mary-Kate Schellert.
Who's Mary-Kate Schellert?
His whiny daughter who wants to be the hippie.
Okay.
Emily Ann Lloyd, the younger daughter who doesn't act and doesn't have a headshot. Miko Hughes, Max Elliott Slade, and Gene Spiegel Howard.
Oh, is that his dad?
That is his mother.
Where is she?
She plays Lovell's mom. Yeah.
Wow, she does a fantastic job.
Yeah, she does a really good. She's.
Well, you should state that Ron Howard always puts his family in all the movies. He puts Clint Howard.
Yeah, she was also in Scrooge and Cocoon.
He put Clint Howard. He's one of the NASA techs.
Yeah.
His dad is the old man priest in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it was his mom. But we should also point out, I just want to throw this out there, that we have a Star Trek connection. Not only with Clint Howard.
Yes. Oh, OG Star Trek.
Well, Clint Howard is in Star Trek TOS.
Yeah.
And Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
Max Groeneschek, who plays Rom on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, is also one of the NASA techs for one scene in this movie.
And he does a really, this is a solid throw it away.
Yeah.
He's really good at this. It's also wild to hear his real voice.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty close to his Rom voice.
His Rom voice is just like he's got cotton in his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a lot of really cool pre-production stuff.
Yeah, I imagine you have a lot of fun facts.
So this original screenplay for Apollo 13 was written with Kevin Costner in mind for Jim Lovell.
This is such a Costner vehicle.
Apparently, Kevin Costner looked very similar to young Jim Lovell, so he was
always the first choice.
By the time Ron Howard acquired the director's position on this, Tom Hanks had expressed.
In the way that you look like Ben Affleck, like he does not look like Kevin Costner.
I can see it. I can see it.
I mean, sort of.
Look, astronauts are not really good-looking guys. That's fine.
Oh, I'm going to absolutely agree with that.
While planning the film, Ron Howard decided that every shot should be original and that they would use no mission footage.
I think that was smart.
The spacecraft interiors were constructed by the Kansas Cosmosphere and Space Center Spaceworks because they had also restored the original Apollo 13 command module.
Kansas connection.
Yep. Two individual lunar modules and two command modules constructed for filming, composed of original Apollo materials, but they were built differently so that different sections could be removed, which allowed camera crews to go inside them.
Sure. Classic film trick.
To prepare for their film roles, Hanks, Paxton, and Bacon all attended the U.S. a space camp in Huntsville, Alabama. And while there, Jim Lovell and David Scott, commander of Apollo 13, did actual training exercises with them so that they would actually be able to operate the command module in a realistic way.
Mm.
The actors were also taught each individually all of the 500 buttons and toggles and switches. And it is said that many of the actual things that these actors do in the movie are the real procedures that would have been done.
Wow.
In some scenes, when the Earth can be seen out the windows of Apollo 13, it is one of the photos that was taken by Jim Lovell and Bill Anders when they were on the Apollo 8 mission that was projected outside the thing. And also, this is something that I mentioned to Ashley. The beginning of this movie starts with a voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a new piece of audio that Ron Howard had Walter Cronkite, famous newsman Walter Cronkite, who appears several times in archive footage on screen. He specifically recorded this for this movie.
Can I say, And this is also me speaking to the other non-American.
Should I explain it wrong? Non-race and American people.
This is like, I understand logically the cultural impact of that and of seeing the old footage, but I feel like it is something that is fairly lost on me when I watch the movie.
Well, here's the thing. It is, he is very American, right?
And look, that's just where you're raised.
Walter Cronkite was once called the most trusted man in America.
Mm-hmm.
He anchored the CBS Evening News for 19 years from 1962 to 1981.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's won the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yeah, yeah. He's one of our better journalists.
He's won a Peabody Award. I actually think he's one of the last broadcasters, at least in America, that was seen to be trusted,
mm-hmm.
to be fair and impartial. But he is just legendary. I think there's a reason why every like past film always uses footage of Walter Cronkite.
But that is cool that they went to him and that he recorded stuff for them. Mm-hmm. That's very neat.
Fun fact, this is the first Tom Hanks feature film to have Tom Hanks portray a real person.
Oh, interesting.
He
would go on to do it a billion more times.
Exactly. Director Ron Howard calls Apollo 13 his absolute favorite of every film he's ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron Howard says of the Apollo 13 launch sequence, he says, "I think as a filmmaker, that might be the most cinematic thing I have ever done."
Are we going to talk about that sequence later?
We will.
Okay.
Yes. So again, Apollo 13, fun fact, we already mentioned the Murderer's Row of films. It was the third highest grossing film of 1995 behind Die Hard with a Vengeance and Toy Story.
Oh, sure. The first Pixar film. Yeah.
Its budget was $52 million.
Wow.
And it
can't make a biopic for that now. Can't make a slice of life for that now.
And it made $355 million worldwide.
Well, I can't believe we didn't get Apollo 14 right after. Now you would get Apollo 13.2.
Jim Lovell returns to finally get to the moon.
To fight his greatest nemesis, the man of the moon.
Apollo 13.
He didn't get to go to the moon, but he's going to Mars.
So, actually, I want to talk about, we're going to talk about the rewatch here.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, you know, the movie opens where, with a lot of NASA movies open with the astronauts watching Neil Armstrong and the crew of Apollo 11 land on the moon.
Yep.
You know, they're bringing the kids in. Everybody's there. It is this, you know, there's not many moments, I would say, in the history of the world, even For All Mankind, a space television show, also begins with this scene.
For All Mankind, by the way, shares a character with this movie.
It does. It does. Well, Neil Armstrong is also in For All Mankind, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I meant Deke.
You took a Deke.
You're right. For All Mankind.
Deke Slayton, as they say, real person. The man who chose who went up in all the spacecraft. What do you think about that choice that so many like movies about astronauts begin with that scene? Now, For All Mankind might have done it because of Apollo 13. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't deny that Apollo 13 was a landmark movie. Because
for sure.
Nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
You know, and again, third highest grossing movie, like third highest grossing movie of the year. But what do you think about this choice here? I mean, and is Apollo 13's version of this scene, you know, successful, or is it cliche now in the rewatch?
Oh, okay. So,
but is it cliche because they did it first?
I have sort of struggled thinking about how I want to talk about this movie.
Oh, please. Okay. Because I know you're not a big fan of space.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
I have no romance for space whatsoever.
It's interesting. I think we've just, based on last month, we have flipped. This is my romance. Like Shakespeare is your romance. Yeah. Space is my romance.
Like I like the stars. I've never had a single desire to go there. Every time I see space, I'm like, that's dangerous. I don't want to go. Like, nothing about space appeals to me.
Maybe I should make clear to the listeners as well, and I've said it so many times, I do love space so much. My original career, I wanted to be an astronaut. And another reason I picked these movies is that because these movies like helped me live that dream that I could never live.
Yes. And I don't want to be disrespectful of what I know it means to you.
It's fine.
Like as a concept and as a story.
Look, I probably was disrespectful to your Shakespeare love. I apologize. So please be disrespectful.
But
of
I
my
just,
space
I
love.
Just like, disrespect I don't want to, I don't want to come out here. Like, cause there's a phrase that I use when I talk about space to you.
Yeah.
that has a big swear in it, and I don't think I want to say it in case we ever air this publicly.
Well, you swore in the last episode, so
yeah, but
matter.
That one was never going to be in contention for something that we would take out from behind the Patreon wall. Mm-hmm. This one might. It's basically like
I'm
fire really, truck space I'm, is my feeling about going to space.
I'm releasing all of these.
So to your question, mm-hmm. Is it cliche? Yes. Does it? It does nothing for me personally as a viewer to see people standing around their living room watching Neil Armstrong walk. Like I don't care. I just don't care. That being said, did For All Mankind do it because Apollo 13 did it? Maybe. I think For All Mankind gets away with it because For All Mankind tells an alternate history and kind of spins. Yeah. That's their version of this scene is the turning point. It's the thing that is different. So you present it in a familiar, dare I say, incredibly cliche way to let your audience know that this ain't your daddy's space race or whatever. I think Apollo 13 is probably responsible for making it cliche.
Well, can I throw out an idea to you?
Yeah.
Can you name me other TV moments? Because again, TV's only been around since like the 50s. Other TV moments that have changed, not just America or Canada, the entire world. Because the only other one I can think about is 9/11.
So that also like marks our age.
Of course.
9/11, of course, is the first thing that comes to mind. Uh-huh. I'm certain there was something.
Well, because another one that I want to throw out, but I don't know if it affected the world beyond America, is Nixon's resignation and the shot of him leaving.
Yeah,
the White
I don't
House.
Know because I just I don't know. Or the death, I don't know
the,
from that.
The death of Kent. Like, see, like the death of President Kennedy in 1963. I don't know if that affected much of people outside of America.
I don't know. I don't know. Like, I want to say, like, surely there has to be something from mm-hmm. like World War II, but I think that was more radio.
No television. Yeah. Yeah. There was no television back then. Yeah. Has to be 50s and above.
You know, I mean, I'm inclined to be like the...
Like, do we think the invasion of Iraq in like 1991?
I don't know.
You know?
I don't know. It's certainly hard-pressed if you're talking about worldwide.
Yeah, I'm talking about worldwide.
I think you're hard-pressed to come up with something other than that. And what is nice about this particular type, the scene, is whether or not you want to go to space. Like, it's a hopeful mm-hmm. story, mm-hmm. right? It's not like we're going to war. Or someone has died, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it is a positive thing. Someone's going to comment and be like, this and this and this and this.
Well,
and this
I'm
and
certain. And,
this.
And please do.
Yeah.
Please do. You know, the movie moves forward. Of course, we get, you know, the classic scene that you see in every NASA scene where, you know, Jim Lovell is getting a VIP tour of the NASA building. And we get all these questions about, like, well, we've already been to the moon. Why should we go back? And he's like, of course, progress. You know, It's the argument that I hate about space all the time. And I hate that we're still having this conversation to this day where you're just like, you know, changing the frontier, fighting the frontier, creating progress is never easy. It takes sacrifice. It takes money. It takes time. And people never want to spend that. And I'm glad that this movie at least checks this. But of course, we get very quickly that Jim Lovell learns that he is going to be flying Apollo 13 and not 14. And so that means he gets to team up with Gary Sinise and Bill Paxton as Ken Mattingly and Fred Hayes. And fun fact, if you haven't done a Google of Ken Mattingly, who's played by Gary Sinise, please do it, because I didn't know much about this guy during this movie. And then I was Googling him as we were watching this movie. And Ken Mattingly might secretly
lived a life, man.
Might secretly be the coolest astronaut that ever lived.
Yeah.
This man set so many records that have not ever been broken.
And designed a bunch of stuff.
And he designed a bunch of stuff. Yeah, yeah. And like, he lived a hell of a life. And he retired as an admiral.
Yeah, and he also saved these guys' lives.
Yeah. but the big thing happens here is that you learn that the surgeons say that Madeline is exposed to measles. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they will not let him go. And that's why they switch out him. They say, you can't go on the mission. And that means that Jack Swigert, played by Kevin Bacon, is going to be their new pilot, which creates a big conflict because they're like, well, we trained with Ken.
Yeah.
And
also, they don't really like Kevin Bacon.
They don't. Well, he's the rookie.
Like, not disrespectful, but he's just like not their guy.
Yes. You know, let me of this crew of, you know, the Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton, Gary Sinise, Kevin Bacon crew. Mm-hmm. What do you think about their performances? Do you buy them as a team? Do you buy them as friends?
I think Gary Sinise crushes it in this part.
I'm going to say this.
I think Gary Sinise and is unsung because like this is not a sexy part to play.
Can I throw this out here?
Sure.
I think Gary Sinise is one of the most unsung actors that was in films in the 90s. And I think he doesn't get his due because he kind of left films in the late 90s because he did that CSI show for a while.
CSI New York.
Yes. And he was so much better than that show. And
He took a regular paycheck.
I'm not insulting him.
No, I know.
He damn straight took that paycheck.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't think he ever gets his due.
I was going to say, I think when people...
He's amazing.
When people think of Gary Sinise, they either think of CSI New York or Lieutenant Dan. Which, by
the year before this.
In one Best Picture.
Yep.
Do you know what one Best Picture in 1995 that stole it from Apollo 13?
You know, I'll look it up.
I looked it up.
What is it?
My Beloved Braveheart.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Because I was like, what one instead?
Do you know what were the five movies that were not? Was it a murderer's row of movies?
Braveheart, Apollo 13, Babe.
Oh, man.
Il Postino. Oh, The Postman.
The Postman was nominated for Best Picture?
Il Postino, The Postman.
I don't think that's the right one. Click on it.
And Sense and Sensibility.
Sense and Sensibility. Babe deserves to be nominated for Best Picture.
A 1994 comedy drama co-written by and starring Mauricio Trossi and directed by English filmmaker Michael Radford, based on the 1985 novel Ardiente Paciencia, Burning Patience. Mm-hmm. Itself adapted from a 1983 film. The film tells a story in which a real-life Chilean poet... Oh, it's a Pablo Neruda biopic, and he befriends a postman. So, like, yeah. It's not...
But it's not Kevin Costner's
The
Postman.
No, it's an Italian language.
There were two movies called The Postman. In 1995.
It was up for Best Director. Wow. Like, yeah. Babe was that much of a thing?
Yes. Yes, it was.
That children's movie?
Rewatch it. I will put it out here. Babe,
I have not watched Babe in 20 years.
Ashley, the first Babe is an astounding movie.
Wow. Do you know what won Best Adapted Screenplay?
Let's hear it.
Sense and Sensibility by Emma Thompson.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Cool. All right, anyway.
Let's go back to Apollo 13.
Yeah.
There is a bunch of, you know, Marilyn has space nightmares, which is a little cliche, but... We meet Gene Kranz as played by the astounding Ed Harris, who I also believe was nominated for an Oscar for this role. And we get to the launch of Apollo 13, which, again, it's hard to talk about because.
He was Best Supporting Actor nomination.
It's because, you know, it's epic. There's James Horner's music. I'm going to say this right now. I think the sequence of Apollo 13 taking off, the shots of Gary Sinise on a Malibu beach watching it with a CGI comp shot, which doesn't look too bad, actually. I actually think this is one of the best sequences that have ever been filmed. I agree with Ron Howard. And I think that sequence it gives me goosebumps every time I watch it. It is probably one of my most re-listened pieces of film score music I've ever heard. It's the piece I can hum, the James Horner. In fact, it was so well-received. NASA actually shows this sequence sometimes in training to its astronauts because they think it is like one of the most realistic portrayals of a launch. What do you think about, again, very silent? What, as a person who is fire truck space, what are your feelings watching this sequence happen?
I don't like it and it gives me anxiety. I don't, and it's played a little bit that this way to like scare you. Mm-hmm. I do find parts of it very anxiety inducing. I think the CG doesn't super hold up.
It's not CG, it's models.
I think the models don't super, like there mm-hmm. is something about it that looks fake. Mm-hmm. And that's the movie's almost 30 mm-hmm. years old. I understand logically it's a well-made sequence. I do not enjoy watching it.
Okay. But like cinematically, do you think it pulls off? I'm not asking, you know,
space anxiety. Yeah, I guess.
You know? I mean,
I don't think it's as epic as you do,
I
think it's impressive. Yes.
If someone were to ask me name like the 50 best scenes in film of all time.
This would never even enter my brain.
Oh,
no.
This would be in it. This would be in the top 25. Again, that it to me is the power of film, is no dialogue, images and music, and it's compelling. Just by editing and just by camera work, it's compelling as hell. Okay, so basically, you know, we fast forward and we get to, you know, again, another shot where like nobody watches the Apollo 13. Like, oh man, the Americans don't like space anymore. Which I'm kind of glad that the movie moves past, because we get very quickly to they cycle liquid oxygen and the electrical short causes the tank to explode. And we get the very famous and often quoted, "Houston, we have a problem," which is probably one of the most famous lines in film history.
In pop cultures. Yeah.
It's parodied. Yep. It's in every movie trailer. I can remember during these Oscars, because this is when I was still watching the Oscars, they played that clip a million times. Like, "Houston, we have a problem."
It's also one of those, it's like, "Bye, Felicia." Like, it's, it is just delivered, like, it's not designed to be, like, the line of the movie.
Yes, and it becomes the line of the movie.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, like, that is the thing that, like, the collective consciousness clung on to.
I would say that people that probably have never even seen this movie could quote that line.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't watch this movie until maybe 2014. And I knew this line.
Okay, so basically from this point on, this is where the movie really becomes almost a documentary.
Yeah.
Because they have one fuel cell, and they're fighting that, like, oh, are we going to be able to land this on the moon? And they finally give, NASA gives the decision that we do not have the power to land on the moon. And Gene Kranz, played by Ed Harris, basically says, we are going to bring these astronauts home. Failure is not an option. The very classic, you know, exposition scene where he draws the diagram on the chalkboard and says, we got to get the astronauts to here. So Ashley, I have to ask you, when this movie turns into documentary mode, I mean, where do you think, like, do you think the first half of this movie is better than the second half? Because from this point forward, it is basically something goes wrong, they find a solution to it. Something goes wrong, they find a solution to it. Something goes wrong. Like, from here on out, it is basically like, will these guys die in space? And of course, we have a little bit of a knowledge that we know they did. If you know anything about history, you know they didn't.
Also, they rarely make movies about people who die.
That is true, because
most of the people survive.
Yeah. But what do you think about that most of this, the rest of this movie, becomes like this very serious, like, working the problem. Oh crap. Oh crap. Oh crap.
Yeah. I think it's definitely better. I think the beginning is a bit slow, and I think it's,
I agree.
I think it's a bit trite. I think the, like, nobody watched their broadcast and my son is supposed to be on television. Like, I don't know. I'm just like, they're some of the most famous people in the world. I think they're fine. I'm not saying that this wasn't, like, a horrible thing to go through or whatever, but, like, I just don't I think it's a little boring. And I think once they get out into space and the explosion happens, that's when it really kicks into gear. And then, like, the movie feels very quick from that point forward, but it feels like, in my memory, it takes a long time to get there. You know, I'm not a scientist, but I imagine that being a scientist, which is what astronauts are, they're pilots or whatever, but, like, they do science and maths, is all about fixing problems. And obviously, we're doing this narratively to keep the drama clipping, because they're up there for 8 days. And these are all presumably real things that happened to them. But I do think once the explosion happens, the movie moves at a good clip from that point forward.
Well, and then also it's kind of beautiful, because I do love the sequence that, you know, there's a big argument of, like, do we just turn the ship around, or do we use the gravity to slingshot around the moon? And I will tell you that this was the first movie that I ever realized that you could do that, that you could use the gravity of objects to
physics, baby,
to speed you up. And
then every comic book and science fiction thing ever does this.
Well, I actually think that the first movie, at least for me, that I can remember doing that actually is Star Trek IV, because they do that with the Klingon Bird of Prey. They slingshot around the sun to speed through time.
Yeah, they do. The Expanse loves to do this type
but
of stuff.
But it's true. It's
no,
true.
I know.
Yeah.
And it's science.
And this is real. They actually did this to.
And it's probably one of the things that saved them.
We get a really amazing sequence where they watch the moon pass and they see like their landing site. And it's like the two guys, you know, and all of these men have this dream. Like, we start this movie off this really great sequence where Tom Hanks is like looking at the moon with his thumb.
Yeah.
And he's hiding, you know, he really dreams to go to the moon. And then when he gets to the moon, he does the opposite to Earth.
Yeah.
And this is the second mission that Jim Lovell goes to the moon and doesn't land.
Yeah.
On it.
He doesn't ever land on the moon, right?
He never lands on the moon. He never lands on the moon. He got within 86 nautical miles.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah.
He orbited the moon twice.
Yeah.
In fact, the first time, I think he orbited the moon like 60 times before he came up. This one, he just did one loop around, came right back.
Oh, yeah.
what do you think about, I think the music is a little wonky at this point. Mm-hmm. But I think the movie does a little bit of a great job with playing with this idea of getting so close to your dream, mm-hmm. but not getting to fulfill it.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about this sequence?
I always think the sequence is weird.
Okay, why?
Because they're literally dying. Like, they're dying for most of this movie. Bigger things to worry about than their ego about landing on the moon. And I know that we're doing this because it's poetic and it's a film. And like, maybe he had a moment up there. Maybe they all did.
I can almost guarantee you they did.
But I'm literally like, when this sequence happens, I'm like, you have things to do.
That's not how humans work, though.
I'm like, why are you wasting your time looking at the moon?
That is not.
Who cares? Go home.
People care.
No,
that's not how humans work.
I literally watch the sequence and I'm like, you are wasting time. Go home.
Humans are not logical, actually. They're very not logical.
I know, but
we are emotional sacks of water.
These characters actually have to be incredibly logical. And if these men had not been logical, they would have died.
Well, yes.
They would have had a panic attack. And they would have died in space.
But like, it's one of those moments where
it's a beautiful sequence for a movie.
I think that actually happened. I really think it actually happened.
I'm sure it did. I will never read the book.
You know,
I'm sure it did. But like, I watch this and I'm just like, this is a waste of time. Go home. I think the thumb thing is a neat callback. Mm-hmm. To the earlier scene in the backyard with his wife.
So this movie also has, again, we have several problems, right? We have. They're going to freeze. There's a sequence where their carbon dioxide filters are running out and the guys at NASA have to, like, very classic scene that I've seen parodying a million things where the guy's like, all right, we got to make this square thing fit into this circle thing. And we only got the stuff on the table. So figure it out, guys.
Well, do you not think that that's what actually happened?
I do, but I have also seen that movie parodied in a million movies. Yeah. Like, that has become a cliche
now.
Well,
then let me ask you this back about the question about the launch. Like, do you think that has become cliche because of this movie?
The launch has become? What are you asking me here?
Well, them all watching Buzz Aldrin and on the moon, them watching the moon landing. Like, you asked me that if that was cliche at the beginning. Do you think that the scene where they're fixing the air filter is cliche because of this movie?
No, I think it has become cliche, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's cliche in this movie. But anyways, as I was saying, I was talking about, we have the power loss. We have the carbon dioxide. We have they can't land unless they only have so much power. Which of the, I guess, disasters, because there are different level of disasters because mm-hmm. we keep piling on top. Which do you find to be the most compelling?
That's interesting.
Or which do you think this movie actually, because all of these actually happen, but which do you think in terms of the dramatic storytelling of this movie, which one is it? Is it we don't have enough power to re-enter the atmosphere? We're going to bounce off the atmosphere. We don't have enough power. We have too much carbon dioxide. Which of these do you think they do, or for you, speak the most to you?
Well, I confess that, like, there's a lot of things that I understand logically about this, but like, I don't really like them bouncing off the atmosphere, like, kind of does nothing for me because mm-hmm. like, it's something I only understand logically. Mm-hmm. Like, I have no concept of what it's like to bounce off the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. That kind of like, it does, but it doesn't make sense to me as a problem. Mm-hmm. I know it's a real problem. I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
I just can't quantify it as a real thing.
Can I ask a follow up to that?
Yeah.
Do you think this movie gets too heady sometimes? Let me ask you this.
That's hard.
Because that's a something thing. Do you think this movie doesn't explain itself enough?
No. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. But I'm just trying to point out that, like, in the slew of problems, to sort of make my point about what does resonate with me.
Sure.
There are some things where I'm like, I understand logically that stuff bounces off the atmosphere all the time, mm-hmm. but I have never seen it. Mm-hmm. I will never see it. And I've never experienced it. So there's a difference.
Until you go to space.
I will rather die. Because if you go to space, you die.
Sometimes.
That is what happens.
Not every time.
There's a difference between understanding something logically and like understanding something like really in your body because you've experienced. So like the thing that resonates for me is how cold it is.
Okay.
And in they do a good job from like day three forward. Mm-hmm. You see their breath and you see how cold, like my favorite scene mm-hmm. has to deal with how cold it is in space.
I love.
Because I understand that, being cold in a really weird way.
I love that you see all the instrumentation get frosty.
And the condensation.
And then when they come into the atmosphere, it all like, there's just water like dripping
and
on
melting
them.
And
it's
stuff.
It's such a great
yeah.
touch. It's
yeah,
such
yeah,
a
yeah,
real.
Yeah.
Whoever, like what set decorator decided to do that,
yeah.
or maybe it was Ron Howard or whoever decided to do that, oh, chef's kiss.
Because like I also understand that like they turn the heaters off or they turn them as low as humanly possible and stuff because they're trying to save the amps and the instrumentation mm-hmm. and all this. I think it is such a cruel thing to do to those people.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So there's also a really strong B story in this movie. Of Ken Mattingly, NASA superstar, played by Gary Sinise.
Oh, I love this, yeah.
And he is in the module, and he is trying to figure out, because they only have like 20 amps or yeah. something like that to enter the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to be like, okay, we've turned the computer off to save power, we have to turn it back on, and yeah. we can't use more than 20 amps.
Yeah.
What do you think about the sequence? Because he's constantly like, well, don't give me that. They don't have that up here. Or I can't leave here because they can't leave
Yeah,
there.
That's actually probably my favorite plot.
Do you think, because there's some parts for me that I think that Gary Sinise plays it so dry. And maybe Ken Mattingly was very dry. Maybe that's a detail
Gary
that I don't
Sinise
know.
Is pretty dry.
But like, there's some points of that for me that is not as interesting.
Oh, that's
me.
So, I find him compelling because to me, I don't know if Ken Mattingly was ex-military, mm-hmm. but that is like military vibes
okay.
to me. Like he feels like a very real person to me in this. I think one of the reasons I like his storyline so much is the first time I watched this movie, I was with Jason and his family.
Yeah, my little brother.
And your mom said when they brought him in to help out, she was like, I feel so bad for him. And you were like, why? He's mm-hmm. on Earth. He's fine. Mm-hmm. And your mom said, I bet he wished that he was up there with them.
Yeah.
And like your mom saying that mm-hmm. resonates with me oh. so much about this character. Like I feel so bad for this character.
Yeah.
Being like, it should have been me.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I buy like how detached he is. Cause he's like, I'm going to fix this problem.
Sure.
Because it should have been me.
Yeah.
And I actually really like the sequences where you see him throughout the movie.
And it should have, because you later learn that
he didn't get measles.
He didn't get measles at all, which was an
actual. Fred Hayes was the one who was sick in space.
Actually, Fred Hayes got a urinary infection is what happened to him.
Yeah. But he was fighting an infection, which is why mm-hmm. he was ill. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So we finally get the landing procedure, they get all the things. They're not certain about the heat shield. It's a very dramatic sequence where they're coming in. And if you don't know this, when you're re-entering the atmosphere, there is always a 2 to 3 minute, sometimes 4 minute cutoff because the heat is so intense. You can't send out a radio signal.
Yeah, it's just like how when you take off, you just pass out for a little bit.
Yep. So it's this very
intense. Why do you want to go to space?
It's amazing. Because there is this very intense sequence where we're wondering, are they alive? Are they not? And eventually they land and we get the classic like voiceover where we explain like what was the cause of the explosion and the careers of all these men. And the real Jim Lovell actually is in this movie. He is the admiral who salutes Tom Hanks mm-hmm. on the carrier. He's now passed away, but that was him.
Well, he was ancient when they made the movie. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, think about it. He was doing this in 1970
as a
young man.
Yeah.
What do you think about the conclusion of this movie? This movie does something. Sometimes this movie has no epilogue. This movie basically is the climax is they land. The movie is over.
That is correct.
We get like 3 minutes of an epilogue and that is it.
You don't need it.
Well, I agree. And this is something that a lot of biopics do. It's like we make the big event is the climax and then the movie is over.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Is it successful in this? And do you think successful in other movies?
Yeah. I want to ask you something about an earlier scene
about space.
When we're done with this.
Okay.
No, I think it's great because I don't like biopics where you get 85 slides at the end.
You mean like Return of the King?
telling you, Return of the King has no slides at the end.
I'm just saying, like, oh, you mean talking about the little text. But Return of the King has a long epilogue.
It's
but,
not a biopic.
But I know. I didn't say it was.
But I don't enjoy that. And I don't enjoy, like, there is a probably a version of this film at some point, even if it was just an idea in development, where, like, he gets back to land and his wife, who's been kind of nasty this whole time. I can't decide if I think Kathleen Quinlan does a good job or a bad job in this part.
I think she does a bad job. I'm going to put and that out there. Like, I've never particularly liked her anytime. Yeah, she, to me, honestly,
she's fine.
She's the weakest
the
part of this movie.
Awful.
But also, that is also a cliche that...
Yes, this is like the cop's wife even, or the military
yes, the
wife.
The cop's wife yeah. who doesn't understand her husband's job.
Yeah. And she like throws herself into his arms and they kiss. Like, I'm glad we did not get that. Mm-hmm. I think the ending is perfect because all you need to know is they got back safe.
Yeah.
Like that's literally all that matters. Mm-hmm. And if you've never looked it up, the actual photo of them all coming out of the little pod is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They probably stank so bad.
I think they would have stank anyway.
Yes, they would have.
Even if they hadn't gone through what the, but yeah, I mean.
Even if they hadn't been around all their urine and poop bags.
Yeah, and vomit and sweat,
yeah.
and et cetera. Yeah, I mean, they probably all smelled really bad.
Yep.
Least of their concerns, I'm going to say. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, there is a moment about yes. halfway through the movie where Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes fight with each other. They argue.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like screaming at each other. And Jim Lovell has to like calm them down and be like, we have bigger things to worry about. Stop looking at the moon.
Mm-hmm.
No,
he doesn't say, it's way after that. He doesn't say stop.
No,
looking at the moon.
I was
he
evoking said, my
he,
oh, okay. thing from
he
earlier.
He basically says shut up because we're going to die.
Yeah. Do you think that, is this a piece of fiction?
No.
Or do you think they actually fought up there?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I think they probably almost strangled each other.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Talk about the most high stress situation.
Because to me, this feels the most like tacked on for drama because we have to fight. We're men.
Ask me who I think is the most realistic of the three portrayals.
Who do you
astronauts.
Think? You're going to say Kevin Bacon.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Bingo.
The one who they kind of write off as the dickhead.
Well, they write him off as the rookie.
The young hotshot, yeah.
But think about this, right? When you are in one of those capsules, you are trusting your life
yeah.
to the engineers that built this thing.
Yeah.
Which is the reason why they test it and simulate.
Yeah.
Because you have to trust that this equipment will work.
Yeah.
Because you can't worry about it.
Yeah.
You just got to go. But you're also trusting that everybody in Mission Control, all those scientists and all those engineers have done the math
yeah.
that will bring you home. So again, Kevin Bacon is playing
Jack Swigert.
He's the pilot.
Yeah.
And his whole mission is to land this thing.
Yeah.
And he would know at a certain point where he was like, if they don't give us the exact pitch of the reentry protocols, we're dead.
Yeah. And that's what starts their fight.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he would also be like, I need time to practice this.
Yeah.
I need time to get my head into this game. And I think that's what that scene is. And I know they don't really represent it that well, but he's coming in there and I think he's very much like, guys, they should have given us this an hour ago.
Yeah. He thinks they're going to die and he thinks they haven't told them that they're going to die.
But I agree. I think, and in those situations, and I bet you it happens all the time in space and we never hear about it. He's like, we cannot land without them.
Because like from a cinematic point of view, like, do you make this movie and not have a fight?
Well, that
like,
is
not
true.
Have a screaming match, you know, like that's why I wanted to ask that question.
But I almost think they 100% fought because high stress and they're going to die.
Yeah.
High
and
stress.
They haven't slept at all.
Yeah. And they barely slept.
Yeah.
You can't sleep on spacecraft really anyway.
Yeah.
Here's the true secret about most military missions. You never sleep.
Yeah.
Most of the people doing all those missions, you're not sleeping.
Yeah.
You're not sleeping and you're stressed out of your thing. But that is why you do the training.
Yeah.
Because you do the training and you do the simulations. It is the same in the military, same in NASA, so that you run on auto. You know it so well.
That's why NASA recruits for the military.
That's why you know it so well. That's why NASA used to recruit a lot of test pilots.
Yeah.
Because you know what test pilots do? They trust the aircraft.
Yeah.
They don't let their stress or their fear or anything. They're like, I know how to operate this aircraft.
Yeah.
And as long as I do this, I can land the plane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, other people let anxiety and stress get to them.
Yeah.
And if you're trained right, you don't.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's the here's the real reality of being in places like that and doing things like this. If you actually think about what you're doing, you will be paralyzed by fear.
Yeah.
And you can't let that happen.
Well, what I think is one of the most, it's not my favorite sequence, but one of the most brilliant sequences is early on when the explosion first happened. And it's, and I think it's a very impressive piece of acting.
Yeah.
It's Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton. Every time I think about Bill Paxton, I think about Cabin Pressure and That Woman Shot Bill Paxton, where they're describing like a movie. They're watching a movie on the plane and they go, and that woman shot Bill Paxton. So Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton, and Kevin Bacon are all it's just exploded. They're all talking to mission control and it is the three of them. And they are not screaming because they are not hysterical, but they are, their voices are raised and they are all having independent conversations.
Because they'd all be talking about three different
with
people.
NASA. Yeah. And it is three actors speaking three, and it's a long sequence. It must be like a two or three pages for each of them. And they are doing it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very impressive piece of acting because if you tune into them and you can listen to one actor, they're not just saying gibberish. Like they are having technical conversations that they've had to memorize, but also because to me, that exemplifies in my mind what those type of people must be like in a high stress situation where you hyper focus so you don't have a panic attack.
Yeah. And if I was, if my hope is, and if I was the director of this piece, I would have had people on their headsets talking to them.
At least like an, at least like a PA reading back lines or something like that. Yeah. But I mean, you have to assume that they just did it talking to nothing.
Okay. So now we're going to get into, you know, the things about the rewatch. Ashley, who do you think the best actor in this movie?
I actually think that's a tough question because I think with a few exceptions, everyone does a really good job.
Oh, this is a solid movie.
I am going to give it to Bill Paxton. I have a lot of empathy for Fred Hayes in this movie. And I think he does a really good job at playing an understated, like someone who is sick and tired. And that is hard to do. I think he's really, really good in this movie. How about you?
I think it's Ed Harris as the flight director, Gene Grant, because there's something about him being like, well, I think it's going to be our finest hour. And when everybody else is like ready to like write them off.
Yeah.
And also like, there's something about doing those exposition scenes where like, we got to get them from here to hear that a lesser actor will always screw up.
Great
actor makes those the best scenes in the movie. Like it's very similar.
And he does that, a version of that scene
twice.
Several times over. Yeah.
It's very similar to the movie, The Fugitive.
Yeah.
Which is a great movie, Harrison Ford. And there's a scene in where Tommy Lee Jones is like, we're going to search every hen house, barn house, chicken house.
Oh, yeah.
And like a lesser actor makes that monologue goofy.
It becomes the song where you're like,
And I think Ed Harris takes a lot of dialogue that a lesser of actor would have made. Like he was rightly nominated for best supporting actor.
Ed Harris has been nominated for best supporting actor four times and never won.
That's a shame.
He's very talented.
That's a shame. Ashley, what's the best scene in this movie?
My favorite scene is, I think it's day six or seven. And Tom Hanks is coming into whatever, I can't tell which part of the ship is which because I don't know that much about space.
The command module, the LEM.
Yeah, I don't know which one is which. I have no idea. He's coming into some part of the ship and Bill Paxton is in there and his back is towards you and he's kind of curled up and like there's a split second the first time you watch it where you're like, oh no, is he dead? And he's just so cold. And Tom Hanks just like takes him in his arms and like warms him up. And I think it is just such a beautiful human moment. And it is such like an act of intimacy that you don't get to see between men and you don't get to see between men, particularly of this era. Like I think it is bar none. And then when he like, my other favorite scene is when they're about to re-enter and Kevin Bacon like helps him do up his like seatbelt. I don't know. I don't know what it's not a seatbelt, but his like actual harness or whatever. I think those are like the two of the most human moments that you get in the whole thing. And I just think they're so beautiful every single time. It's not a scene, really. Mm-hmm. It's just these like two quiet moments. But I think it is like some of the most magnificent acting. Nice. So those are my favorite moments.
Yeah.
None of the scary stuff. None of the takeoffs. Just like them looking after poor Fredo because he's sick.
Yeah.
How about you?
I mean, the launch is amazing. But if I have another moment, I love the moment that right when they're about to re-enter, when Tom Hanks sits in the pilot seat.
Oh, by accident.
And there's a brief moment where, because again, the entire movie, they're all like, Kevin Bacon, he's the pilot, he's the rookie. And there's a
and they're trying to decide if it's his fault or not.
Yes. And there's a brief moment where you kind of get the impression that like Jim Lovell was basically who's a pilot. Again, they're all pilots.
Yep.
Might just fly the thing in. And he's like, no, I'm going to trust the guy that trained.
Yeah.
And he's like, sorry about that, old habits. Mm-hmm. And he flips. And that's what I think is like a really, really great moment. All right. On the rewatch, Ashley, did Apollo 13 pass or fail for you?
No, Apollo 13 definitely passes.
Oh, 100%.
Like no, my feelings about space aside, no question.
It's a pass for me as well.
It's a really good movie. Yeah, it's a good movie.
Okay, cool. All right. Now, next episode, we are going to watch this movie.
Some lunatic is out there killing members of the hockey community.
For Detective Martin Ward, solving his latest case is nothing compared to getting along with his new partner.
He's from Quebec.
Martin Ward, David Butchart.
The subject was a true Quebecer. His heart is in Quebec.
Yes, but
his ass belongs to you.
Their cultures don't match.
The subject, divorced, works about 75 hours a week, which I gather from Montreal is a lot.
Their styles don't blend.
This is called Bon Cop, Bad Cop. Ashley, when did this come out? Who is this by? A Colm Feore was in a lot of this.
2006, I think this movie came out.
The top comment on YouTube for this trailer says, most Canadian movie ever.
Okay.
Would you agree with the statement?
Absolutely. No.
It's Strange Brew, I think, is the most Canadian movie ever.
Not if you ask a Canadian. Certainly
it was made by Canadians.
Yeah. It's not beloved where I come from. Because it perpetrates every stereotype that America has about us being stupid. Bon Cop, Bad Cop is a 2006 movie.
2006?
2006.
Wow.
About the difference between Ontario and Quebecois cultures through the lens of a buddy cop movie. I'm not warm on buddy cop movies at all. I've rarely seen one that I thought was good. I think this is a very good one.
There was a sequel to this.
That dude from Continuum that you like is in this movie.
Boy, that narrows it down.
Eric Knudsen. He was the lead of Continuum.
No, I don't think so. Who are you? Eric Knudsen.
I think that's, is that not who this young man
I mean,
is?
He's in Continuum. I wouldn't call him the lead.
I don't know. He was the guy who was on the poster all the time.
Okay.
I didn't watch Continuum.
When I'm looking at the cast list for Bon Cop, Bad Cop, he's like the 15th person.
Yeah, he's in the movie though.
Yeah. That's where he is on Continuum as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. he's not okay. Really in Continuum. Well, he was on the posters.
Sure.
I really wanted to do a Canadian movie.
Sure.
And I wanted to do a movie.
I don't know who Patrick Huard is, the co-lead of this. I've never heard of him
before. He's a French Canadian actor.
All right.
And it explores this sort of tenuous relationships that two of the larger, provinces and cultures in Canada have, but through a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
When this movie came out, it's one of the first Canadian movies that I remember getting an international audience.
Okay.
And people responding to positively. I also wanted to make sure that we, gave our listeners something that they didn't have to pay to watch. It's on, at least in Canada, as my phone wants you to know, it's on Netflix. So okay. I wanted to do a Canadian movie. I like this movie. Colm Feore, you know, I said we need an actor from For All Mankind to continue talking about space next month.
Because you love it.
I love it.
I've never heard of this movie, so I'm excited.
I'm shocked.
Never heard of this movie.
I'm not even remotely shocked that you've never heard of this. It's on its face, it's a pretty typical buddy cop movie, but I remember this being very funny. So
you remember it being very funny. Yeah. Okay, let me ask you this question. Do you think it'll be funny to Americans?
Honestly, maybe. Who knows?
There was a joke in there about a Quebecer, and I was like, I don't understand that joke at all.
That joke or the joke about a 75-hour work week being a lot in Montreal? Because I thought that was very funny.
I don't understand that one either. Can you give us some insight about that joke?
It's sort of the idea that in like English culture, we look at the French as being very like lazy and lackadaisical, uh-huh. and like I'm smoking and yes. I am making love to a beautiful woman. And yes. I'm just, so it's like, well, 75 hours would be like,
not
it's
a lot.
Longer than a yeah. typical work week. Yeah. So that's the joke that like for Montreal, it's a lot.
Okay. All right, cool. Well, we'll check that out next time.
Next month.
Be sure to stick around, and go listen to some of our other podcasts at patreon.com/Jawin. That's JAWIIN. Ashley, where can they find you on social media?
You can find me at Ashley V. Robinson everywhere.
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram at Jawin, JAWIIN. And then finally, do we think we'll ever rewatch Apollo 13? I can almost guarantee you the answer is yes.
You will.
100%.
They made a Bond Cop, Bad Cop 2.
I said that like 5 minutes ago.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Oh, boy.
They made it the next year.
All right, we're going to see you on down the road, everybody. Next time on Film Festes. Bon cop. How do you say see you down the road in French? Let's end on that.
I mean, there's like not a phrase that translates to that.
Just get as close as you can.
Bientôt.